Welcome to WebAx, practical web accessibility tips.
WebAx.blogspot.com.
WebAx. Website accessibility. Web standards.
Hello and welcome to WebAx. This is your host Dennis, and today I have this is podcast number 77, and today I have a special guest with us, Terrell Thompson. How you doing, Terrell?
I'm good. How are you, Dennis?
Good, thank you. A happy New Year to you.
And to you as well.
Thank you. And we were just talking about taking vacation, but actually working on vacation to tie up some loose ends. So hopefully you got a good part of all your tasks completed, at least.
Yeah, I got a few things done. As I was just mentioning, I tend to address all my back burner projects or sort of plan on doing that over the holidays, those couple weeks where I can work uninterrupted because everybody else is taking vacation.
Yeah.
But I don't always get around to everything, so I end up sort of tossing too many tasks into that pile. And so I've got quite a few things to do in December of 2010, I guess.
Yeah, I hear you. I had a big list of tasks to do myself, but I had a lot of personal stuff I wanted to do, so I kind of wanted to stick more to that. But we are doing this podcast, so it's a good start to the new year.
Indeed.
Indeed. Terrell works at the University of Washington, and we'll get more into that in a little while. But I guess if you could just give a basic background about yourself, Terrell, and you know, and your work, and how you got into the field of accessibility.
Okay, well, I'm a technology accessibility specialist. That's my official title, and I work at the University of Washington. I work for the DOIT project, which is an acronym standing for Disabilities, Opportunities, Internetworking, and Technology. And DOIT has been around since 1992. I think we got our first grant from National Science Foundation, and that was to host and coordinate a summer camp for students with disabilities in high school. So starting when they're sophomores in high school, they come to the UW campus and participate in all aspects of college life. So they stay in the dorms for 2 weeks and take classes that sort of give them a feel for what the curriculum is going to be like, you know, particularly focused on science, technology, engineering, and math. And they talk with the disability services folks and learn about you know, what sort of accommodations to expect and learn to self-advocate. And it's a really great experience. It's one that we actually continue to do. We've done that annually since 92 and continue to have that summer session every year.
Since 92, so you've been there that long, huh?
Well, I haven't been there that long, but the program has been operating since then.
Oh, okay.
I came along in 2001. At that time, I was at North Carolina State University doing assistive technology accessibility campus-wide. Washington, just geographically, had always been appealing. And, you know, we spent a lot of summers up here, as my wife has relatives up here. And so we always were kind of keeping an eye out for stuff that we could do in this neck of the woods. And there was DOIT got a grant in 2001 called Access IT. It's the National Center on Accessible Information Technology and Education.
Ah.
So that was a grant from NIDER, the U.S. Department of Education. And so I was hired to come on board as part of that grant. So it came up in 2001. So it was almost a decade now that I've been working for the UW, and that grant, that was a 5-year grant that no longer exists, but I still do kind of the same type of work, focusing on technology accessibility, particularly as it's used in education, and most of that is web accessibility focused, although I do sort of explore other technologies as well. And all of our grants, and we've gotten a number of grants over the years sort of piggybacking off of that original effort with the summer camp. But our focus is partly on empowering students, so kids kind of develop skills and learn what to expect in college, and learn self-advocacy skills and those sorts of things. And so we're basically empowering kids to pursue their dreams and, you know, challenging careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. But along with that, we also have had a number of grants that sort of work to build capacity within post-secondary education settings so that colleges and universities are better equipped to provide education to students with disabilities. And then also with employers, we've had grants where we work with employers and help to create internships and educate employers on accessibility issues, those sorts of things. So basically we're trying to break down all the barriers for these kids who are interested in challenging careers so that they indeed can go ahead and pursue their dreams.
That's great. So. And for those listening, if you're interested, it's that I'll put any links we mentioned, of course, I'll put on the show notes. But if you want to right now, go to washington.edu/doit, and that should take you to the main Do It page that talks about a lot of these programs and stuff. What were you doing before this position?
I think like a lot of us, it's sort of a crazy, convoluted path.
Uh-huh.
But I got my bachelor's degree in psychology and was determined to see what I could do with that. And everybody sort of said, you can't really do anything with a bachelor's degree in psychology. And
right.
everybody I went to undergrad with was sort of going on to graduate school and had plans of, you know, getting their PhDs. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to accept that as a challenge and see what I can do with a bachelor's degree in psych. So I blanketed the country with resumes and I got two nibbles. One of those took me to Kansas, where I did psych research for the Menninger Foundation. I'm just a research assistant, and what I ended up doing there for the most part was database management. There really was nobody on staff that had any sort of technical skills, and mm-hmm. I didn't have at that time either myself, but I had at least an adventurous spirit, so I was willing to plunge in. And at that time, we had an IBM PC XT, and everybody was really excited about it. And, so I plunged in and, you know, learned to use it, learned to use some of the tools. And after the grant I was working on there ended, then I had computer skills, so I was able to go out into the workforce and did corporate computing for a few years. And all the while, I still sort of wanted to get back to using psychology, doing something more meaningful. And I discovered assistive technology to be an area where I could sort of unite my interests,
mm-hmm.
My new interest in technology, as well as my long-standing interest in helping people.
Yeah, it's challenging work too, right? And it's rewarding.
Yeah, from a technology standpoint, it's, you know, this cutting-edge technology, some really interesting things that are happening in the AT world. And so I also at the time was commuting from, I lived in Lawrence, Kansas, was commuting to Kansas City. And it was about a 30 to 40 minute drive every day, and, you know, to a job that I wasn't enjoying a whole lot. A position became available at a local independent living center there in Lawrence that had a computer training facility specifically for people with disabilities, and they were looking for somebody to coordinate that.
Ah.
It was within biking distance of home, and, you know, so everything just sort of fell into place. So
that's cool.
I applied for that, got the job, and that was my entry into the field. I worked there for a number of years, and in that position, we were sort of a regional resource related to assistive technology and web accessibility, technology accessibility. Did a lot of outreach working with educational institutions, both K-12 as well as post-secondary. Worked some with the University of Kansas as well as other institutions, just trying to help students who were having some difficulty with access to technology, you know, trying to work with educational entities to, provide more accessible, technology-based curriculum and tools and resources. And so as an outsider, trying to tackle that problem, I came to appreciate that being an insider within higher education really would allow me to have a greater impact. Mm. And so that's when I started looking around for jobs within higher education institutions that were doing this kind of work. And they're actually, at that time, they were plentiful in the late 90s. And so I ended up going to North Carolina State to do that kind of work as their AT and technology accessibility person.
Okay. Well, that gives us a good idea of your background. So looking forward, you mentioned when we emailed that the focus in 2010 where you're at, one of the focuses is going to be video accessibility.
Yeah, I'm working on that from a couple of different vantage points. I do provide support, accessibility support at the University of Washington in addition to working on the DUIC grants. Actually, at the moment, I'm entirely funded by federal grant dollars, but that kind of changes. Funding just sort of fluctuates all the time. Every couple months, I'm funded, you know, different percentage here and different percentage there. So it's kind of tough for me to keep track of. But at one point, I was 50% funded centrally by the university. And DUIC resides within the UW Technology group, and so that's the group that provides core technology support campus-wide. And so my role there is to provide accessibility support campus-wide, and there actually are a few of us that do this kind of work. But so I'm no longer funded specifically by the university, but I still work with the university, funded by these grants. And so with regards to video, I have been working with folks who are sort of centrally spearheading YouTube video efforts. That has become kind of centralized. Historically, video and most other technology-related things at the UW have been very decentralized. Everybody kind of does their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great frontier. And with YouTube, there's a real effort now to sort of rein that in, because we had, I forgot what the number was, it's something like 25 or 30 different channels all representing groups at the UW out there on YouTube. And so I think it was sort of spearheaded by the central marketing group on campus who wanted to kind of get rein some of that in and get people sort of doing some consistent things related to branding. And just there's a real interest there. And so a video steering committee was formed that represented people from all across campus who were doing video work. And so I was actually invited to participate in that group and brought to the table accessibility concerns, as well as the fact that we had done quite a bit of video production over the years ourselves at the DUIC project. We've got over 40 videos that we've produced. And we've done some pretty innovative things in terms of captioning and audio description. And so folks do kind of turn to us as an example, I think.
So can we find this at that youtube.com/UWHuskies?
Yeah, UW Huskies is the main UW presence.
I'll check it out now. Yeah, it looks nice.
So hopefully a number of those videos that you see there on the UW Huskies page are, in fact, captioned. Our goal at one point was for that to be 100%, but we've fallen a little bit behind there. And at this point, we've done the captioning manually, and we're sort of exploring different strategies for doing that effectively and efficiently, and what sort of workflow models make sense for us, and how can we ultimately, the goal is to caption everything that we produce. So, we produce thousands of videos. And so we have a lot of people at the table who are talking about this problem, and our first sort of effort was to do some benchmarking just using interns. We had a pool of student interns. It was actually funded by one of our grants, where we have money to provide internships for students with disabilities. And so we hired a team of students with disabilities to sort of manage this captioning project. And We ended up using DotSub as our tool, dotsub.com, I believe it is.
Okay.
And we built some kind of an internal project management system, and had this team of interns captioning UW Huskies videos as they went up on YouTube. And so the turnaround time was pretty quick, and we logged, you know, how much time it took, and we're right now in the process of sort of tabulating some of that information and doing a cost analysis. And we captioned 30 videos with that team. I think there may be a couple still that are outstanding, but we're sort of wrapping up that phase of the project, I think. We've got these benchmark data, and ultimately, we'd like to see, you know, what we can put in place that will be a little bit more effective in terms of widespread implementation, a little more practical for getting, you know, all the videos at the university captioned. Because I think, you know, 30 videos over, it's been like a 2-month period, really is just a very small slice of the pie in terms of the amount of videos that we're producing.
Yeah. Hey, Ev, have you seen the presentation by John Foliot at Stanford about their captioning system?
Yeah, I've seen that. That holds a lot of potential. It'll be interesting. It's fairly new still, and so it'll be interesting to see what sort of buy-in they get from campus and, you know, how effective that ultimately will be. But it looks like a great system they've put in place there.
Yeah, it seems like it's working pretty well so far, and it's, like you said, it's not even a year old, I think, so.
So we're looking at that. We're also looking with some excitement at what Google is doing, with the Google captioning service, and we actually are in the queue to be part of the next wave of, testing that they're doing. So they just have, right now it's only available for a limited number of, channels, and, we're in the queue. They haven't given us a time specifically when we'll be up, but
for the auto captioning.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so
yeah, that'll be interesting to see how accurate it is, huh?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, some of the early signs, you know, have been a bit laughable. I think that, you know, there's a lot of inaccuracy still, as would be expected. But
yeah,
I have hopes that, you know, with the Google engineers being who they are, you know, they're going to be bringing lots of data in with this, and they're going to be able to improve their product.
Now, so, do you know, I wonder if, say something's auto-captioned by them, like, will the owner be able to take that caption file and edit it themselves? I imagine they would, right?
I think so, yeah. I haven't got my hands on it yet, so I don't know that for sure, but,
yeah.
You know.
Sounds promising, though.
It does, yeah. So I think it'll be editable. I've heard folks say that it would be exportable into other formats, which is another interest of ours. You know, YouTube is only one channel. We've got video all over the place in different formats.
And mm-hmm.
So we'd like to be able to not only automatically caption, but be able to export that into formats that we can use elsewhere and be able to edit as well.
Yeah, in translation too. I mean, especially for a university, right? Then once it's captioned, it can be translated. I know Google, have you seen, not a lot of people are aware of this, but the YouTube videos, if it's captioned, it has like automatic translating to different languages.
Yeah.
It's far out.
And that's a great selling point too, for captioning. We've been talking about captioning for years. You know, as I mentioned, I've been in this field for, you know, since the early 90s. And, you know, over the years, it largely, you know, as we talk about web accessibility, it largely, you know, we were talking about issues related to access for people who are blind. And it certainly extends to other groups as well. But, you know, they seem to be the group who is primarily affected by inaccessible web design. And so we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, alternate text on images and those sorts of things. But now as we're getting more and more multimedia, then, you know, people who are unable to hear that content are really impacted significantly by, you know, the amount of inaccessible content that's out there. So we've been talking about that for years, but we haven't gotten a whole lot of buy-in just because it's, you know, requires a lot of time and a lot of resources in order to caption or transcribe multimedia.
Yeah.
But we're starting to get some traction by presenting that from a universal design standpoint, that And I think this is why Google's interested. It's not just about accessibility. It's about being able to search. And that relationship between captions and search is a real important one. And one that, as we've been presenting that, you know, more people have gotten interested than if we'd just been talking about captioning for accessibility's sake. And now that we can present automatic translation on the fly, people are extremely excited about that. And at the UW, you know, there was a key moment, actually, that I can remember being at a meeting and turning folks who were, you know, sort of paying lip service, I think, to, yes, we need to caption, you know, it's our legal obligation, we have to make our video content accessible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they hadn't really done a whole lot other than say, yes, this is important. But in this meeting where I demonstrated the automatic translation capabilities, jaws just sort of dropped. And, you know, people became, at that moment, genuinely excited about making this work and getting more caption content out there. You know, if nothing else, just so it could be translated on the fly.
Great. Hey, let's move on to some more fun topics. Captioning could be fun for some people.
But it is fun. It's all fun.
No, captioning's cool. but this topic is even more fun. The NCAA college basketball tournament bracket.
Oh, yes.
So this is one of your personal projects, I assume. Although, I guess it could be a project for a university, especially if you're in North Carolina, huh?
Yeah, or everywhere I've lived in my entire life has been, I grew up in Indiana, which is, you know, basketball is the pastime. And then I moved to Kansas, which, you know,
another big basketball school. Yeah.
North Carolina's basketball country. So, so it's in my blood. And, this all stemmed from a conversation I was having with, a couple of blind colleagues independently of one another, right around basketball time, March Madness.
So for those outside the United States, March Madness is every year in March, there's a huge, how many teams is it? 64?
It's now 65, yeah, but it 64, and then there's a play-in game for that 64th spot. But.
Oh, is there? Okay. It's a 64-team gigantic tournament for the college basketball title. Whoops, there's my home phone. For the college basketball national title. So anyways, yeah, the brackets are online are inaccessible. Sorry, that's what you were going to say probably, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's true. So imagine a, you know, bracket with 64 teams in it, and they, you know, they all sort of cascade down to there being one final champion. And so
I just want to interject that they're, you know, it's a challenge to make that on the web and, you know, and a usability challenge and a technical challenge to make that bracket, you know, in on a web page. And I can imagine, you know, how difficult it would be for a blind user to try to use it, or how difficult it is to try to make it accessible.
Right. So as I was talking to my colleagues and friends who were basketball fans, the joy that I experience as a sighted user around March Madness time is looking over that bracket when it first comes out, mm-hmm. and, you know, sort of looking to see who's playing who and what potential matchups are going to happen, you know, second round or third round, and, you know, really studying that bracket and getting excited about what some of the possible games are going to be. And then, you know, filling out a bracket and competing with other people, you know, in terms of...
No betting, though.
No betting, yeah, no money.
No money exchanges.
Bragging rights. So that's a very challenging thing for somebody who can't see this visual bracket to get a handle on and to be able to compare games and get a look further than the first round and you can try to understand who's going to be playing who. And so the goal with this was to present this information in a way where non-visually somebody could get a sense for the relationship between games and between rounds and could move forward and backward through that bracket and really get the same sort of pleasure that a sighted user gets and the same sort of information that a sighted user gets. And so so it's been tweaked a little bit over the years. I've done this since, I think, 2006 with the first one. The form that it currently is in, based on feedback from users, and it seems to be working pretty well, is it's broken down into regions. And so we got four regions in the country, and so we break it down into manageable chunks. Mm-hmm. So break it down into regions, and then within that we break it down into four different rounds, because there are four different rounds of games within each region. And then each of these sections has a heading or a subheading, so that people can very easily jump within regions and within rounds using a screen reader.
So the regions are headings, and then the rounds are headings underneath each region.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then within that, each round of games is an ordered list of games, and then there's a nested list of two teams within each of those ordered list items.
Who play, yeah.
So that
the two teams who play in that game.
Exactly, yeah. And so so then that we use CSS to stylize all that so that it's presented in the way that a sighted user typically would expect a bracket to be presented. And so so it works really well then for sighted users as well as non-sighted users. And
that's awesome.
It's gotten a lot of positive feedback, and you know, folks who otherwise didn't have access to brackets now have access to brackets. And I have a lot of feature requests, too, and so it's becoming, every March it's kind of a time hog where I have to devote some time to, you know, getting it in shape before the next round, before the next tournament comes around. But one of the feature requests every year has been a pool, you know, again, no money, bragging rights only, but, you know, screen reader users want to be able to participate in a tournament pool, and you know, the social aspect of doing that is a fun thing. And all the tournament pool forms that I've seen have been incredibly inaccessible. Yeah, I haven't seen one yet that a person with a screen reader could fill out, or a person who doesn't use a mouse could fill out. And so probably the goal this year is to create an interactive you know, form that people can fill out and then sort of track their winners against the actual winners and, you know, participate in that whole tournament pool thing. And the World Cup is coming up as well, and I've had some requests from folks to extend this to other tournaments, especially the World Cup. So I'm you know, not 100% sure what I'm going to do with that, but kind of contemplating, you know, something like Bracket ML. It's some sort of, you know, XML language that could communicate all the stuff that's in a bracket, you know, all those relationships. Mm. Could be easily portable from tournament to tournament, and maybe use XSLT to stylize it. And, so
that would be really cool.
Yeah, lots of possibility. I kind of see this as a playground, too, you know, so playing around with different technologies. And I imagine the 2010 is going to include some ARIA markup as well. So it'll be fun to kind of keep an eye on that as March rolls around and see you know, what the accessible tournament bracket looks like this year.
Awesome. And if you want to take a look at that, go to terrellthompson.com/ncaa/bracket.html. That's awesome. I'm looking at the code. It's really clean, and I mean, I love your work, which is why I wanted to get you on the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, you do great work, and I also I didn't put this in the list of things to talk about, but I did see that you kind of fixed up the Blogger template to be more accessible. Is that what your TerrellThompson.com is? Is that from Blogger?
It is. Yeah, it's a Blogger blog. Basically, I started blogging, I think I'm kind of late to the blogging world, but a couple years ago, I jumped into the blogging arena, mainly because there were a lot of things I was doing at Do-It that weren't being captured anywhere. So I my role at Do-It as technology accessibility specialist is to provide consultation, first of all, so people who are partners on our grants or people who are representative of populations that are targeted by our grants, such as science educators or computer science departments, those sorts of things. And I provide web accessibility support to them, and then I develop resources and do trainings on web accessibility support. But a large part of my time is also just spent exploring technologies and looking at accessibility issues related to those technologies and, you know, implementing and, you know, trying to innovate in terms of web accessibility. And so all that work, you know, there really isn't an official sort of vehicle for distributing that within Do-It. And so I started blogging just to kind of capture some of that work that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to kind of jump into it quickly, and so I just signed up for a Blogger account and grabbed one of their default templates, and I've been using that just out of laziness ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And as the blog has gotten a bit more traffic and a bit more attention, then I started thinking, well, you know, if I'm talking about accessibility, I really should have a more accessible blog here. And so let's see, some of the things, and I blogged about this a couple of blogs ago, and so...
When did you make the update?
It was just like early December.
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
Yeah, because I remember I saw a tweet about it, and I wasn't sure if you had just done it or what.
Yeah. So it's pretty new. But if I changed from what had been a fixed layout to a liquid layout with a larger default font size, and the original had a very small
mm-hmm.
font size had. In a couple areas, some poor color contrast, which is all of the default templates seem to sort of suffer from that problem. I added some ARIA markup, just landmark roles, so folks using screen readers that support landmarks can jump from section to section. Visible focus for keyboard users, so if a person's not a mouse user and they're tabbing through, then you know, they can easily keep track of where they are.
Good.
There's also, the Blogger has a CAPTCHA feature, which can be turned on or off, and I actually had always had mine off, just, you know, so that folks can comment without having to go through CAPTCHA, because
mm-hmm.
Google, although they have the ability to do an audio CAPTCHA, they don't have that, they're not utilizing that within the Blogger setting, and so it's just a visual CAPTCHA. And I turned that off so folks can comment.
So how do you get around the spam?
Yeah, I haven't spammed excessively. There have been a couple of instances, but I filter all comments, so everything has to be approved. And you know, if I get spammed, then I'm willing to suffer through that. Even you know, at some point. We might reach a breaking point, I guess. But so far, you know, again, I haven't gotten that much spam, and so I'm willing just to go in and, you know, not approve any spam. And
okay.
then, you know, I'm the one who's burdened with having to do that rather than burdening my users, you know, who I'd like to be able to comment, but, you know, not everybody's going to be able to do that because of the CAPTCHA.
Yeah, that's, you know, WebAx is a Blogger blog.
Mm-hmm.
I have this... the same conundrum because I get a ton of spam on there.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. It's a whole nother conversation we could have.
Yeah.
But anyways.
So the lingering problem is HTML validation. I'm not able to get it to validate. And there are a few things that happen through Blogger tags.
Yeah.
Don't see a way, at least at the moment, I don't see a way around that those tags are going to inject invalid HTML, yet they inject key dynamic content. There's really no way around you know, having those tags in place. So,
any plans to maybe share some of your Blogger template knowledge?
Yeah, possibly. And I don't have plans to do that specifically, but I'm certainly willing or happy to. Everything I did is documented in that one blog post, and so you can kind of, you know, get an overview, there. And you could probably also just, you know, check out the CSS and, you know, plug that into your own template as well. But yeah, but I'm happy to share any of that. So.
Yeah, that'd be great, because I think the community could probably, I'm sure it could use something like that. And same with WordPress. So I'm, again, running into, WordPress is set up pretty well, you know, with web standards, anything. And there's a lot, you know, here and there that can be fixed up. But I'm starting a couple new projects with WordPress. Mm-hmm. And I'm also getting requests from folks about, or just discussion on Twitter and everything, just about the fact that there's no accessible WordPress templates, or a pretty big lack of them.
Yeah.
So I'm looking into that right now. Hopefully I can provide something to the community soon. So.
Yeah, that'd be great to be able to do that.
The first stage, I think, is just a cleanup. And I think the second stage after that, you know, is to add in, like, maybe do HTML5 or add in some more bells and whistles. Did you know I just found out in doing this that the latest default WordPress theme, I guess they call it, has Aria in it.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, they've incorporated like some Aria like landmark roles and stuff. So,
oh, excellent.
Yeah, I was pretty happy to see that.
Yeah, that's nice. So the word is definitely getting out.
Yeah.
Good to see.
Yeah, it's good to see it happening.
Yeah, as somebody that's been doing work in the web accessibility and technology accessibility arena since the early days of the web, it sometimes is frustrating that there's been so little progress, you know, that there still are so many sites that are inaccessible. But on the other hand, you see things like that, you know, where there is implementation at a high level, you know, within various organizations and various tools, and you know, that's pretty exciting, you know, and it's I think more and more web developers, from my perspective, and vendors as well, are aware of accessibility and are starting to implement it. And we actually have done some research in that arena too, that show that at least our research is focused on higher education websites, and we have just completed a longitudinal study that's going to be published pretty soon here in the next couple of months, I think. Mm. But that shows over a period of 4 to 5 years that the sites we measured, which is all institutions across Carnegie classification within the Pacific Northwest, they are getting better on support for basic accessibility features. So images are more likely now to have alternate text than they were 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They're more likely to have, pages are more likely to have a good HTML heading structure. You know, so those things are gradually starting to fall into place. But we're also observing a statistically significant deterioration when it comes to things like the ability to access all features just using keyboard, not using a mouse.
So
I think we're seeing, you know, some web 2.0 type things, you know,
yeah,
dynamic interactive kind of features, and you know, navigation menus that have fly out or drop down components and haven't been coded accessibly. Those sorts of things are sort of, even though people are aware of accessibility, then they're choosing to deploy inaccessible new emerging technologies,
mm-hmm,
maybe just sort of hoping or planning that they'll fix the accessibility at some point down the road, but they're not letting that stand in the way of, you know, implementing some of these new technologies. So we still kind of have a new problem, or still have an accessibility problem that's sort of shifting focus.
Yeah. Interesting. WebEx. Hey, so you're going to be at CSUN this year.
Yeah. I've been to, I think, almost every CSUN. It's kind of one of those conferences that I go to every year. I do a lot of conferences with our federal funding. That's one of the things I do, is go to conferences, do trainings and presentations, workshops, those sorts of things.
So which conferences do you attend the most? So CSUN?
Yeah, so what I consider my two, maybe three regular conferences, you know, sort of the must-go-to.
Mm-hmm.
Conferences. CSUN is one of those. The other is Accessing Higher Ground, which I think you were at this past year. In fact, I think we may have even had dinner together and didn't realize it.
Really?
Yeah, we were I believe we were at one long table.
Oh, yeah, at the brewery?
Yeah, and I was on one end, you were on the other, so we didn't get to talk, but, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Small world.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, so those are kind of my two main ones. I also do EDUCAUSE. I'm pretty active within the EDUCAUSE organization. And High Ed Web has also recently, just a couple years ago, become one of my favorites. It's a great conference for people who are doing web development within a higher education context, which is kind of similar to Accessing Higher Ground. It's small enough to where you've got a very narrow focus and people who are all doing very similar sorts of things and, you know, similar type of work.
Mm-hmm.
Great opportunity to network. So CSUN, I think, is still the best in terms of, just assistive technology, and it's a place where you're pretty likely to run into anybody who's working in this field. So a ton of great sessions and, yeah, great networking opportunities.
Yeah, I'm going for the first time this year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Never been to San Diego.
Yeah, should be fun. That's a new venue at CSUN, so it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, maybe we'll see each other there. Maybe if we see each other, maybe we'll be able to talk this time.
Yeah. Well,
tweet up. We'll get a tweet up going. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's already some talk of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The one of the bad things about any conference, really, but CSUN in particular, is that there always are so many sessions that you want to go to that are, you know, maybe similar in focus, or certainly, that's true. I was looking over the schedule just recently, and I'd love to see your accessible Twitter session, which is, 8 a.m. on Thursday, I think.
Yeah.
And you're up against another session with Andrew Kirkpatrick and Matt May talking about Flex and Air accessibility. And so it seems like every time slot has something like that where, oh, man, I really want to see this, and I want to see this. And, you know, it's hard to decide between the two.
Right. Yeah, so I'm presenting with Joseph O'Connor on accessibility of Twitter. Not only the web accessibility, but other... Well, I'm going to be covering the web part, and he's going to be covering the other parts, like mobile and desktop apps. So that's the plan. What are you speaking on?
I've got a session later that day on video accessibility.
Oh, okay.
So it's going to be kind of a step-by-step look at video accessibility. So I really want to get beyond just the abstract, you know, why do we need to do this kind of presentation, and look at, you know, what are some tools for adding captions, you know, how do you use them, how do you, build an accessible player for deploying your video, and, you know, as much as I can do within 60 minutes, you know, provide some real concrete, usable information for people to take home and try.
Good. Yeah, I'll have to try and attend that one. But is it, how many go on at one time? How many sessions at a time? It's all in the one same place, though, right? Is it in a new venue in that big hotel?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how it works at the new venue. Historically, it's been in the Marriott in Los Angeles.
Oh, I heard, like, by the airport or something?
Yeah, so it wasn't the best location from a tourism standpoint, but it was. I actually thought it was a nice site. Maybe we had outgrown it, but they... Yeah, the Marriott really, over the years, had gotten good at accommodating, you know, such a huge number of people with disabilities.
Mm.
And that, you know, after they had announced they were moving to San Diego last year, I was in the lobby of the Marriott, and somebody dropped a glass, and it shattered, and so there's glass and liquid all over the place.
Yikes.
And it was really impressive how quickly the Marriott was on top of that, and they had staff standing around making sure that nobody, you know, walked into that situation, you know, if they couldn't see it. And, I found myself thinking, I wonder if the new venue is going to be as quick to respond to a situation like that, you know, because these folks really seem to have it. So.
Well, let's hope so. It looks like a really nice place.
Yeah, it does. WebEx.
think we've touched upon everything we wanted to talk about, except one final, an even more fun topic, and that is your music.
Oh, yeah.
So, you even have a MySpace page I checked out this morning.
I do, yeah. Not very accessible, but not much you can do with MySpace.
No. Yeah, so I listened to a few of the songs, and I still think my favorite one is the one that I'm going to play as soon as we finish the interview. So the Man with Small F, is that the name of it?
Yeah, it's Man with Small F and subtitled The Inaccessible PDF Song.
Oh, it's because of your inspiration, right? Is that I breezed over your... You had written something about the inspiration for that song. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that was a student had come into my office with a PDF document that she wasn't able to access, and she said, "Hey, I've got a problem with this document. It's really sort of being read in a strange way by my screen reader. I'm trying to figure out what's going on with it." And so I gave it a listen, and this was during February last year. It's February album writing month. There's a couple of web communities that I participate in February. One is FAWM, which is FAWM.org, February album writing month. And then there's another called the RPM Challenge. And both of these are communities that are focused on producing music all within the month of February. So take the shortest, darkest, coldest, and wettest here in the Northwest month of the year, and let's just have a good time and make music during this month. And so the goal is different depending on which community it is, but with FAWM, you try to produce 14 songs within that month. So you're looking for inspiration everywhere. But in this case, when I took her PDF document and I plugged it in and launched JAWS, and what it read was just this really interesting nonsense, but it was attempting to read it. So that was particularly interesting. That JAWS was reading it, and the read out loud feature within Adobe Acrobat Reader was also reading the document with inflections, but it wasn't making any sense what they're saying. And so, I helped the student, and that actually, I think there was a non-standard font issue that was kind of at the core of that particular problem. That involved going back to the instructor and sort of giving them some coaching on developing or creating accessible PDF,
mm-hmm.
and kind of having them redo that so that it was accessible rather than trying to go in and retrofit it. But as soon as I got home, I had this document still, and I thought, this is just so poetic and so musical that I had to do something with it, and so I set it to music.
Nice. Okay, well, without further ado, I will play that right now.
Awesome.
So thanks for joining me, Taro. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you.
You too. Thanks for starting the new year with this conversation. It's great. I feel honored to be doing this, and I'm looking forward now to 2010.
Me too. Well, we appreciate your work, and you really do great work. And like I said, that's the main reason I wanted to have you on the show, in addition to all your other cool stuff that you're doing. So thanks again, Taro.
You bet.
Multiplication sign sense counts f backslash right square bracket at asterisk k f f point f f point f point f f point f f point f asterisk f point f asterisk f point f f point f f f f f point f point point f point point f m right square bracket k f f right curly bracket point point f point f asterisk f point f asterisk f point f f f point f f f f
Webex.blogspot.com. That's WEBASE.blogspot.com.